And welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz. I got nothing.
I'm
all flustered, people.
You got the meat sweats from having some street meat
today.
Yes,
we were talking about sausages.
Yeah.
There you go. Things so to
hopefully,
avoid.
Hopefully things will get better in the next 30
seconds.
Yeah,
hopefully I'll start jonesing for steaks or something.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to cfru.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today, we will check in on the province of Ontario, in which we happen to live. And we just marked the halfway point of the mandate of the Liberal government. And they celebrated with a ceremonial changing of the cabinet. So how are the Liberals doing 2 years in? And in spite of the numerous crises and issues they're sitting on, maybe they have a shot at re-election in 2 years. That certainly seems to be what people are talking about, the point of this week's cabinet shuffle. But we'll get into that in a few minutes. And then later on the show, we will have Ward 5 City Councillor Kathy Downer in studio to talk about the affairs of the City of Guelph, which are starkly different from the affairs of the City of London, which we were also talking about before the show. Just
for
kidding,
show,
London. Anyway, OMB reform is something Kathy Downer has been championing, so we'll talk about that. Energy policy, overtime issues at City Hall, infrastructure money coming in. We're going to have lots to talk about with Councillor Downer, and we'll also have a couple of your questions. So stay tuned for that at 5:30. But first, and sadly we have to address what's been a massively tragic week in the tourist town of Orlando, Florida, as the specter of mass casualty gun violence puts the so-called Sunshine State in a pall. 49 dead, 53 injured at the Pulse nightclub by a gunman whose motivations seem to be multiple choice.
Yeah, and hearing that Obama had addressed this, this was the 15th time he may had to make some kind of statement about a mass shooting.
Yeah.
Of a... There's mass shootings all the time in the States, but of the ones of the level of death and destruction of Orlando is phenomenal. And over again, we see it and over again. As you say, it's kind of a multiple thing. It's not weird, but you can almost see it coming that, oh, okay, is America due for another mass shooting? And then when you hear about it and the news is trickling out and initially it was so many injured and that turned out it was so many dead, the pattern remains the same. I look at it, it's almost like one of those old style combination locks where all of these factors come in and then there's a mass shooting. The fuse to the bomb, of course, being the how easy it is to get an automatic weapon in America. And the it was in the Philadelphia Times initially. Also in the Star today, one of the reporters there got an AR-15, which is similar to the gun that was used in 9 minutes. She said it took longer to take it, turn it into the police, than it did to buy it. And she was just doing it to make a point that it is that easy.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people worldwide, not just in America, who are homophobes. There are a lot of people that are aligned to radical Islamic groups or think they are. What was the term that I heard this time? It was internet radicalization. I don't think I've ever heard that one.
No,
so they've come up with a new, which is true in a way. I mean, that's part of what's happened. The suspect sounds like he was prone to domestic abuse with his first wife. All of these factors, and no one factor is any lesser or greater than the others. There's a lot in there. It's like, oh, we shouldn't talk about this. It's actually about this. It's about homophobia. It's about the strange thing about this, and it keeps happening too, is like it's sort of in the last minute of play. He decides, oh, yeah, oh, by the way, I'm doing it for ISIS. It's happened more than once, right?
Yeah.
Again, it's a factor, of course, and not to be, you know, not to be trifled with, obviously, in terms of that being a factor as well. But the number one thing that everybody keeps coming back to is why is it so easy for somebody to get a military-grade gun in the United States? It's almost is almost impossible to get. Well, it is impossible. It's a restricted weapon in Canada. You can get an AR-15, but it only shoots 5 bullets. There's no large magazine. It's just not on. You couldn't. You probably could modify one if you really wanted to, but that's why the key difference here, as we saw in, say, the Parliament Hill shooting, was that the gun that he had shot like a bullet and then you have to reload it, or an automatic, 5 bullets max, and then you're out. If the Parliament Hill shooter had a gun like an AR-15 or Sig Sauer or whatever we was using this, it would have been a completely different story. We'd be seeing the same kind of thing here in Canada as we're seeing in the United States. Absolutely, because all of the factors are in place. And the one that's missing is the gun.
Yeah, and I think that's something that purposely gets buried. You always hear in these situations, oh, it's too soon to talk about politics in regards to gun control. But in this case, it wasn't too early to talk about, as you said, what was one line to, I think, a newsroom. He called a couple of newsrooms and said, I did it for ISIS. I did it for the Islamic State. And it's never too early to politicize this and talk and turn it into a thing of how Barack Obama doesn't use the word radical Islamic terrorist, which Obama came back and said, well, they're not magic words. You know, identifying them as such doesn't make it go away. What I find weird in this case is everyone kind of wants to attach their own issue to it in terms of his motivation. A lot of people want to think he's an ISIS sympathizer. Well, he said the line, this is for ISIS. And apparently he was scouting for targets, too. There was talk about how he was considering other locations in Orlando as possible targets. But on the other hand, there's all this other thing about how his father said that what set him off was seeing two men kissing, but at the same time, he apparently was trolling gay dating sites and actually went to the club in question on several occasions. Whether he was scouting it for later tragedy, I don't know. But, I mean, when you go on a gay dating site, it's going to end one of two ways, with you not getting a date or you getting a date and ending up kissing a man. So there seems to be maybe some sexual orientation confusion afoot here, as well as ideology. And what it all comes down to, I think, is that this guy was a nutter. And in the United States, nutters are able to get their hands on pretty wicked weaponry that only in the United States you seem to be able to get your hands on that easily. It took me longer. I have this MacBook Air in front of me. It took me longer to buy this MacBook Air Buy than it takes you to buy one of these guns in places in the United States.
Or when you were in getting your phone worked on there. How long were we there?
It's like,
I've looked at all this stuff, and he's still talking to her. So, and it is true. And I think I've talked in the past about my own gun training, in quotes, experience in the States, where in Ohio, it was like 20 minutes, you're on the range, and then you come out, and if you're American, they give you a little ticket, and you can walk out with a gun loaded in your pants, and you can go to Walmart and go shopping with a loaded pistol in your pants within an hour. Mm-hmm. Less if you want. You don't even have to go to the range. They show you what to do with a gun, and they give you a ticket or a permit. It was like, you're allowed to carry a concealed weapon. This obviously wasn't a concealed weapon. He had a Glock as well. It doesn't actually matter which or what guns. The key is that gun is designed to just kill, kill, kill. They're not difficult to use. You don't even need a chorus to use that kind of gun. It's point and shoot. It's like a camera. It's like the camera on your phone. You point it, and a bunch of bullets come out really quickly, right? So that's...
An AR-15 isn't designed to go hunting.
No.
It's, you know,
but this is the argument in Canada. People are like, well, we should be able to get this up here. The only reason AR-15s are available in Canada is it's a bit of a loophole, because there are shooting competitions and that, where people in the military, whatever, are involved, and that gun is a factor, right? It was back in when did that gun, it was under Kretschmann, right? 93, 94, 95, somewhere around there, 20 years ago. There was a brief period, I believe, in the States where they weren't allowed, that they were banned. And then I think it was the Congress, rather than revisit it, it's one of those sort of like, well, there is no law. And then, of course, like a day later, everybody's buying them. There's millions of them. There's not just a few hundred thousand of them out there in the States. They say it could be as little as 5 and upwards of 10 million automatic weapons under people's beds, in their closets, in their freaking cars in the United States. And that is scary.
And we're not talking about malicious either. It's Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, was on CNN yesterday saying, well, I have an AR-15. And I'm like, why do you have an AR-15? Why? You're a sitting senator of the United States. What? You're not going hunting with this thing because you're going to be spitting out shrapnel from the meat that you bring home from that hunt for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
You know, those things, you know, aren't designed for precision shooting. And if you get caught in a situation like what happened at Pulse, what are you going to do? You're going to say to, you know, because you can't carry around an AR-15 with you on your person. So if you get caught in one of these situations, which is the picture they paint, that, you know, you have to arm people so that they can fire back. You can't, you can't carry around an AR-15. And what's he going to say in a situation like, hold on, terrorists, I want to make this a fair fight. So I'm going to drive home, get my AR-15, come back, and then we'll keep doing this.
Yeah.
It's completely nuts. The other part of that, though, is this. And I do call it a fantasy scenario. It was so weird. I was watching AMC the other day, and one of the Dirty Harry movies came on. I can't remember which one it is. But there's a scene in a Chinese restaurant where these, what you would call them meth heads now. I don't know what they were in like the 70s or 80s when this movie came on. But they come in, they start roughing everybody up. They start stealing everybody's wallets and jewelry and stuff, and they come into the restaurant, and they get to Dirty Harry's table, and they come to Clint Eastwood, and he says, "You forgot your fortune cookie," and he snaps it open and says, he said something like, "You've made poor life decisions," and then he shoots every single one of them with relative ease.
With this 44 Magnum.
Right, and it's a complete fantasy, first of all, because a Magnum's a tough gun to handle.
Yeah.
A lot of kick on that.
And you don't just have it in your pants. Some people do, I suppose.
But this is the fantasy. All these terrorists come in. Only one man with his concealed gun can save them. Bam, bam, bam. Situation over. You're a freaking hero. And that is not what that would look like if that were to happen in real life.
Dark nightclub, lots of noises to begin with. I mean, it's not as if you're talking about ideal conditions. There are no ideal conditions with something like this. There really, really isn't. And of course, who surfaces? I was wondering when I first heard that this had happened, how long is it going to take before some Christian nut job says, "See, you reap what you sow," whatever the biblical line is. And it was within minutes that somebody had posted. And of course, the Westboro Baptist Church, who get far too much attention for their 40-some-odd congregation.
Yeah, for sure.
Their URL, and I believe I can say this this time of day because it's a direct quote, godhatesfags.com. That is their URL address. You're going to expect nothing less than crap from them. They're saying, and this is a church that also hates Muslim, I mean, they just hate everybody, that God sent the shooter, right?
Ugh.
So that's the most extreme example of what's come out with this, right? Because you knew it was going to happen. And then you've got guys like Trump. Like, no context whatsoever as to what to say about this. So then you see, it's the Muslim terrorists. Yeah, the ones that are, like, born and raised in the United States, right?
Yeah.
And then converted. Exactly. And then, you know, there's a whole bunch of other factors. It's just so easy for him to point. And then all the gun nuts and everybody go, yeah, he's right. He's so right. Yeah. Oh, it's those Muslims. Oh, it's not the guns. They're in the hands of the wrong people. Like, the usual crap over and over again. When does it end? It only ends when they go back to the, you know, Second Amendment, whatever, and get the muskets back. I mean, I would be more impressed where people were so Second Amendment that they kept a musket under their bed, right?
Yeah.
Then you'd say, okay, that's what it's about. But not, this is just, they'd never expected that science would come that far, that they could develop a weapon that could do this. You're like a one-person army.
I'll do you one better. Even if it was just like limited you to a revolver.
Sure.
6 shots and you're done.
Yeah.
No, the Trump thing was interesting because you talked about Obama at the top. One of the tests, and I think in this election is going to be like who can make the best comforter in chief. And some people have called it the desk test. Like, who could you see sitting behind a desk talking to the American people in a time of crisis? Can you see Donald Trump getting on Air Force One, going to a town that has suffered, like Orlando has suffered this week, in order to offer comfort to first responders, to family members, to the community? That is...
Never.
Yeah, you can't... I mean, you want the tough guy stuff. I understand that. But there's a flip side to this as well, that he has to have a quality of leadership that is to... more akin to a shepherd than a soldier, let's say. And Donald Trump does not fill those boots at all. And indeed, there are a lot of Republicans saying he failed that test. Republicans saying he failed the test.
But we're going to back him anyway because he's our presumptive candidate, and we have to do that.
And he's I can't remember who this – my sister pointed this out to me. She's like, there was some senator, Lamar Alexander, who said somebody asked him about Trump, and he said, I don't know why you're asking me about Trump. And the reporter said, well, he's a presumptive nominee. And it's like, well, according to you. It's like, no, according to the Republican voters.
No, you're an idiot. No, you're an idiot. Yeah, one of those basically, arguments just never ends, yeah.
The flip side to the extremists, though, is even like the non-extremists, because I rarely compliment CNN on anything, but Anderson Cooper interviewed the Attorney General of Florida, Pam Bondi, who has said some – it was one of these people who won't support gay marriage, won't support LGBT rights.
I don't want to talk about them.
But here she is on live TV talking about how we have to come together and support the community. And Anderson Cooper said, well, you know, your own public comments previously haven't lent you to show much support to that community that you're now asking to rally around. And of course, and she's taken extraordinary umbrage to Anderson Cooper hanging her with her own words. And she said she's gotten hate mail and threats. I mean, nobody should get hate mail and threats. But on the other hand, there's some kind of hypocrisy being enjoyed here. There was also a Georgia congressman who got up at the Republican National Conference a couple of months ago and was quoting the typical anti-gay...
The Bible?
Yeah, the typical anti-gay stuff from the Bible. And, you know, of course, he's one of these people who posts in the Way of Tragedy, oh, me and my wife offer our thoughts and prayers. And it's like, well, if nobody had shot these people, would you still be offering thoughts and prayers to the LGBT community?
No. And that's the governor, too. It's like the most important thing you can do is pray. Like, really?
Yeah.
Really, that's the most important thing we can do in this case, but it just depends who's getting money from the gun lobby.
And yeah, and Samantha Bee had a great takedown piece about that. I wanted to just point out, before we move topics, that the Guelph Vigil for Orlando is tonight at Guelph City Hall. It starts, people will start gathering at 8 p.m., speeches will be at 8:30, and then the vigil will be at 9 p.m., and Guelph Queer Equity, ARC, the AIDS Resource and Community Health Network, Out on the Shelf, Outline, Rainbow Chorus, the City of Guelph, University of Guelph, and Guelph Women in Crisis are all participating in this. That's the Guelph Vigil for Orlando at City Hall tonight, starting at 8 p.m. So if you feel so inclined, I'm sure they would appreciate seeing you there. Okay, looking forward now to Ontario politics. As you may or may not be aware, this is this past week, well, maybe almost exactly 2 years since Kathleen Wynne won a majority government in a surprise move. Everyone expected the Liberals to fall and perhaps fall quite handily, but no, they came roaring back, and it's been 2 years. I think a lot of people, certainly Liberal critics, would say it's been more of the same. And to mark the occasion, Kathleen Wynne decided to shake up her cabinet. There are now 30 people in the cabinet, which means there are more people who are Liberals who are in cabinet, who are not in cabinet, because there's 58 sitting Liberals. 30 of them are in cabinet, so do the math. God. Yeah, I discovered that. I did the math
today
myself.
Nobody unless sitting in cabinet. Yeah.
Wow. But, I mean, the criticism has been that... I don't want to use the lipstick on a pig metaphor. I don't like that.
Once you said it, it's out.
But it's like, or putting a new coat of paint on an old house. And because a lot of people stayed in place. I mean, Eric Hopkins, who's, you know, pretty much poisoned the well with doctors lately, is still in health. You have Charles Souza, who's run deficits as finance minister for years, still in finance. Liz Sandals, who didn't have a good year last year negotiating with teachers. She's not Minister of Education anymore. She's our MPP, as you may or may not be aware. But she is now the President of the Treasury Board of Ontario.
And I think she spent a lot of time on the Treasury Board, right? So it's not as if she's greenhorn to it. It's like,
I don't think she's a greenhorn, no.
No, so probably not a bad move for her. Although I know education was, I think she specifically ran focusing on education. Was she a school board trustee, right?
She was a trustee for years,
Yeah, and I thought was some of the analysis was interesting in that a lot of the cabinet that were let go were seniors. And I mean senior citizens. They were ranging in age from 67 to 75 years old. So I'm not sure if it was the Conservatives that pointed that out. I don't even know where I got those numbers. But the NDP called it a superficial reboot. I think there's some truth to that.
Yeah.
And it seemed like the goal was to get more women on cabinet, and they succeeded in doing that. Of course, it's sort of pumping it up to improve the re-election chances.
Yeah.
What were the new seats? It was like international trade, housing, and infrastructure. Is that right? They just keep changing the names.
Yeah.
It's almost hard to know what a cabinet portfolio is because they keep changing the names of them.
Yeah.
Like industry becomes like innovation and whatever.
I think they added innovation to industry.
Just to sass it up or... What was the other one? Digital, something became digital. Digital information. I don't know.
Yeah.
So they change up the cabinet posts and also change the names too, which also confuses people. It confuses me. I try and follow these things closely.
Minister responsible for digital government. Of course, that went to
digital government.
That went to Deb Matthews. Deb Matthews has like three jobs. She's deputy premier, minister of advanced education and skills development, and minister responsible for digital government.
I got three jobs, man.
She's like, wow. She's running the gambit there.
That's quite the pile. So you think they'd spread the load out a little bit, but I don't know. So, yeah, cabinet shuffles obviously overshadowed by everything that's going on this week because it used to be – I think it used to be a big deal. I remember a shuffle cabinet would be like top of the news, right? But now it's like alligator eats boy, that's top of the news. And then the cabinet shuffle is somewhere down at the bottom. I also thought – oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say it depends on context because there have been times when – I was thinking about the last – federal cabinet shuffle with Stephen Harper. That was the one that saw Julian Fantino move off veterans, and that happened like right after New Year's and after Julian Fantino was like under siege for like for months.
Embarrassing show in front of the veterans there, that where he kind of walked away and that woman was chiding him.
But yeah,
he earned it too. Useless man.
But yeah, it's stuff like that. I think it gets more attention when it's like really is trying to put a new coat of paint on an old house. I think in this context, it's still the same, but there is no sort of one direct reason why she would try to, I don't know, shift focus from something that's affecting them negatively publicity wise in order to focus on something more positive, which would be to shuffle cabinet. But it depends on context.
So if we include the McGuinty years, and we should, they've been the government for 13 years, which is a long haul, and we know that you start to get a bit stale dated around this time. So I think the difference being from last time, as you alluded to, in that the Conservatives had a different leader last time in Tim Hudak. And it would seem to me that people are softening to Patrick Brown, that he's not the same leader that we had the last time for the Conservatives in that, it's just a completely, completely different guy. The same party, obviously. But his comment was interesting. He said, did he describe it as stale as well? Oh, my God, I'm echoing Patrick Brown again. Tired, stale, and self-interested. So that was his descriptors of this current government, and of course that's it's his job to do that. But things should really be looking up for the Liberals these days. I think it was said, it was mentioned in the Star, and that if I understand it right, the budget deficit is set to disappear. They're working on pension plans, free tuition, all these kind of feel good things. Riding a little bit on the coattails of the federal scene. I think there's a little bit of JT mojo going on as well, so there's Liberal love across the nation, right?
Well, whenever Trudeau rolls up at like an Ontario base event, like at Oshawa. I think it was last week when they had the announcement about the GM increasing technology jobs. It was both Trudeau and Wynne. So yeah, she's certainly riding his coattails a little. That's an interesting thing too, is that there was a job announcement, I think, today in Windsor, that they're investing $85 million in Fiat Chrysler.
Really?
To
I missed that one.
Yeah, to get more jobs going in Windsor. So there's certainly a lot of positive economic developments. There was also an announcement this week that two-way all-day GO trains are a step closer to happening in our region.
That's probably a more exciting announcement for us than any cabinet shuffle, right? It's like,
yeah,
my God, more trains are coming. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's not starting like this fall, although there will be more trains this fall.
It's buses to Bramalea or something, right? Like, Nothing personal, Bramley, but...
Well, there are two extra trains that go from Union to Georgetown in the day. Only two, but only two other ones go all the way to Kitchener. Starting in the fall, those two extra lines that go to Georgetown will be extended to Kitchener.
Oh, okay. And you'll leave at weird times and get there at weird
times.
Right.
So, but it's still in the morning and the afternoon.
Yeah.
For people in Kitchener, they will be able to hop a GO bus that will express them to Bramalea so they can catch the train in Bramalea, which they do run all day between Bramalea and the Union Station.
Do they now? Yeah, okay, because for years that they didn't. The one that boggles me is the Guelph bus that goes to Cooksville, which is my old stomping grounds, and there's like one train you can catch maybe in the morning to get to Toronto, and then there's nothing.
Yeah.
The idea is to get people to square one and whatever. As you know, Adam and I could talk about transit all day, but
well, that's not a bad bus route.
I like it. I wish it was here when I was a student, but that was years ago.
Yeah, they did take a step closer. But, CNN agreed. I think it was in principle. It's not like written down with maps and stuff, but they agreed in principle that they're going to start looking at how to move the freight to another line so that they can open up that corridor to
finally
run GO trains all day.
My word.
But it still might be 2, 3, 4
That might
years.
Involve the Junction Railway. It depends on how they're laying it out.
Yes.
We need some train spotting types to tell us, like, well, we'll do this. And we're like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Train spotting types.
Yeah. And was an interesting announcement that I'd heard this week was that the LCBO has made a record profit. So I was talking about selling off the LCBO. The LCBO hauled in $5.57 billion, of which the provincial government gets $1.94, so almost $2 billion just in booze. So, in other news, we're all drinking more. No, I don't know. I think some of that might be people not cross-border booze shopping as much anymore because of the dollar. I don't know. Like, just stay home, suck it up, and pay. I don't know or who knows why that number is so high, but maybe we're all just needing to drink more.
Drinking.
It could be. That's huge. Because I can remember when the LCBO's profit was like $1 billion. Nothing to shrug at, but that's almost two now. So
I wonder,
things should be looking up yet somehow.
I wonder if the LCBO gets a kickback from booze being sold in grocery stores for like loss.
Well, that will take a chunk out of it, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the LCBO, they're still going to get a cut. The government, regardless, the government is going to get tax money from the booze, right? As they do with cigarettes. I saw a guy pay $13 for a 20-pack of cigarettes. And I felt old, but I thought, wow, that is a lot.
Yeah.
Like, there must be a certain price point where people say, I can't do this anymore. Or you're wholeheartedly an addict. And of course, the cigarette tax always goes up, right?
It's the one tax no one complains about.
No, you used to. You just complain about the Toronto Sun and be like, to be the guy with the butt and a bottle of beer going, oh, I pay too much. No one complains about the cigarette tax anymore. What's next? The marijuana tax. That's for another day, probably. But speculative.
The day is coming.
The day is coming for sure, where everybody will want their cut.
For sure. A couple of interesting factoids. Somebody pointed out that this is the second biggest cabinet since PC Premier Frank Miller back in the 80s.
Wow.
He had 33 cabinet ministers in his last term.
There's a blast in the past. Frank Miller in his check jacket. I vaguely remember that.
And then a lot of the new cabinet ministers are from places like Burlington and Halton and Cambridge.
GTA all the way.
And Newmarket.
Yeah.
And what do those four places have in common? They used to be PC seats.
These were ones that converted in the last.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, you.
Plumping.
I would never say that you don't have to shake things up occasionally because you can get complacent. But at the same time, when you start breaking the announcement down to its essential parts, you start understanding the cynical politicalness of it. However, that may be moot because these people may be great at their jobs and help secure the Liberals another majority in 2018, and we'll have to see.
The clock's already running, so.
Yes, and the clock's running for us, and because we have to get our very special guest in here, and we're going to take a break to make that turnover. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
This is K-Train Fitzsimmons playing the heavily distorted chromatic harmonica. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
That was City in Color from one of the 20 City in Color CDs we have in the station. That one is If I Should Go Before You. I'm not sure of the year. And the song was called Friends. And City in Color are playing two shows in Toronto tomorrow and Saturday. And we were just saying this off air that I had no idea City in Color was that huge. But two nights at the Molson Amphitheater is pretty big. So that goes out to Renee and our partner who are going to the show. So,
and you keep calling him them, but it's a him.
Well, it is a band, but it is also a guy. And I was confused because I know who Dallas Green is. But then there's a band on this one, though, right?
Well, I mean, assume he has a backup.
Folks, I don't know what you're going to get at the Molson Amphitheater, but it probably should be a good show.
It could be a hologram.
Shaky Graves are the opening act. We'll play them next week.
Shaky Graves.
Shaky Graves. Is that a guy or a band? We don't know.
I hardly think so.
That's why we try and play music, so we expand our horizons here, because it's like, oh, yeah.
Speaking of expanding our horizons, we have another of our city councilors here in studio with us, Kathy Downer of Ward 5. Hello, Kathy.
Thank you. Happy to be here today in the heart of Ward 5.
Yes, we are in the heart of Ward 5.
Yes. I never think of it like that.
Yeah, she's absolutely correct. Now, for people who may not be aware, you were a city councilor for several terms before you left or retired from city council in 2006. But then for some reason you decided to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So did you miss it that badly?
You know, there were actually parts of it that I, you know, a lot of it obviously I did miss. I mean, when I gave it up, I didn't rule out coming back when I decided not to run in 06. But you know, I had become very busy at that time with other things in my life and decided I couldn't give it my priority that I wanted to. And then I found myself in a time that I could give it, priority again and decided to try coming back and was successful. So, you know, I'm happy to be there.
We always talk about that. No one knows just how much time that goes into this job. It's a part-time job in name only.
Yes, that's true. I would consider it's more full-time. Like, for me, it is, anyway. I try to get out to as many functions as I can. I was here at a convocation yesterday and sort of try to pick up on most of the invitations that I do get to go out and meet with constituents. And there's a lot of reading as well. So it is quite busy.
Do you find any differences now between from when you were previously on council to, and then there was that period you were away to now? Or is it just...
City Hall is very different. I mean, when I was there before, I was in the old City Hall and the new City Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Much bigger.
That's a radical difference.
You know, but I mean, it also creates a different dynamics where everybody's not as close, right? The staff aren't as quite close.
Right.
And so that, but there are new departments and, you know, there were some like, you know, intergovernmental relations. I remember coming back and thinking, like, what's that? What have we got now? You know, and like they have, you know, proven themselves 10 times over that was a good move. And there's a number of things like that. As far as the constituency work is much the same, except it is pretty well all email now. I rarely get a call. Having said that, I had two today, but but I mean those are the first ones.
There's a pothole.
In a few weeks, but so you know that's made that transition. Because when I started in '94, like it was all phone call. We didn't have computers in our homes at all. So that you know it has evolved. You know, each term is different. I mean, depending on the makeup of the council, like so, that's you're going to expect that. So the dynamics are always different, and then who are the staff at the head? Who's the CAO? Who's the deputy CAOs or general managers?
Right. Speaking of CAO, that is a pretty big change. That just it seemed to come up quite suddenly. That Ann Papert did not want to renew her contract, and. Derek Thompson, who was on his way to Caledon, seemed to send up the bat signal and he came right back. I know a lot of this was done behind closed doors and closed meetings, but in terms of outside of observance, it seemed to happen quite quick, both Anne's decision to leave and Derek's decision to stay and get promoted.
Well, they weren't they weren't related at the time. Like he had decided to leave, and then Anne shortly thereafter had decided that she was not going to renew her contract with the city, and she had personal reasons for that. I'm not privy to what all those were. And Derek was going to be leaving, and you know, this council decided they wanted to move very quickly to open up some kind of I think we said publicly there was a competitive process before he left, and we wanted him, you know, to make sure that he was part of that. You know, not that he was in any way anointed by that, but, you know, we wanted him in the mix. Like, we knew that he had been a good, stable employee for a while. And so, you know, we chose him. And I'm very happy that we got that hook around him before he left us. And I think he's happy. I think... you know, it was really fast. It was a fast couple of weeks, and I was on the governance committee, so we were very busy. And but I'm very pleased with the outcome. And they were already such a good team. I think Derek and Mark Amorosi and Scott Stewart, who was fairly new, they were already a really good team. So it's great for moving on. I was concerned before that about, you know, having lost two senior positions like that.
Right.
And I felt we had to move quickly, either with a plan or doing something. And as it turned out, this is what we did. And I think it was a really good move. I think it stabilized things pretty quickly. And he's well respected within City Hall and with outside too.
And I know that's a concern a lot of people have when you have senior managers seemingly depart kind of one after the other, that there's a kind of a brain drain.
Yes.
Is there something to perhaps, some people are saying it might be a work issue, that there might be a lot of it's expected of these people, a lot of blame falls on their shoulders when things don't happen the way they are, when things happen the way they do. To what can you say about that? I mean, because it does seem like it's sometimes either it may be an environmental thing, but on the other hand, you know, you have things happen in clusters. Like Gordie Howe dies within a week of Muhammad Ali. It just seems weird, right?
Yeah, I guess, you know, it. I think civil service is under attack by the public a lot more now, particularly on social media. It makes it more vicious. So it's very different. That's one thing I do notice coming back is that those top positions are much more political, it seems, than they used to be, or they viewed as political. That even though they're impartial, they're often viewed, no matter what they say, as being, you know, partial or one side or another side. And so, you know, there's a lot of pressure on them, on those positions, pressure than there used to be, I think.
Sure.
So I think that makes it difficult for those people in those positions. Like, you have a CAO and you have three deputy CAOs, and they're high profile positions.
Absolutely.
And they become the target of, you know, social media. You saw see it online when Derek announced he was going and when he was coming back, and, you know, all over the place. So, you know, it's, you know, some good, some bad, you know, but it's all out there, right? So they're really putting themselves out there. It's a high stress position, I think. And today we moved, we didn't, but, you know, Colleen Clack was moved into the deputy CAO position.
Yeah, I did get that press release.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about, and you wanted to talk about too, about the Ontario Municipal Board.
Yeah.
And you've been pushing, and that seems to be I don't want to say it's your thing, but it seems to have been your thing that you have pushed this pretty hard, that the OMB needs to reform. So for people who may not be aware, what is it about the OMB that needs to be reformed? What do you think it should be doing, and why isn't it doing that now?
So just to sort of step back where I've been working on that, so it's, first, the Ontario Municipal Board is a tribunal which land use decisions in municipalities are appealed to. There's other things that they do as well, like ward boundary appeals and things like that, but mostly they deal with land use, committee of adjustment, zone changes, official plans. And there's a group of councillors from across the GTA and I have gotten together, and we organized a municipal summit on OMB reform in May and had a panel of speakers, and it was a great day. And we're meeting again this weekend to sort through our findings and hope to make a presentation to the Ontario Association of Municipalities this summer. But Most of the frustration is with, you know, just take the, you know, taking the local decision making out of our hands into an unaccountable, unelected body is a big thing.
Right.
The cost of the OMB, and in our case in Guelph here, so we approved an official plan that went through a long engagement process in 2012. And 4 years later, in 2016, we still cannot implement that official plan because of the appeals by, you know, developers. And so the aspirations and vision of the community cannot be realized.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. And that was, you know, at the summit, that was one of the biggest frustrations. I think it was Vaughn that said they'd spent $14 million defending their official plan so far. That's frustrating. You know, in some ways, it's frustrating for developers, too. It doesn't seem to work for anybody. So anybody can slap $125 down, or and appeal any decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work for residence groups like the McElderry group that just, you know, raised $50,000 and still had to step back out of the OMB process because they couldn't hold any, you know, raise any more through bake sales and things like that. And
right.
They were phenomenal. And so they had to step out and return to or go to participant status, which meant that they were not part of the settlement discussion. So settlement is the sad settlement. It's you're settling for less than what the community originally wanted. So it's
right.
It doesn't really work well for anybody. So it's the motion I brought forward to council is that, you know, that we really want when the province does their review of the OMB this year, we want it to be bold reform, like tinkering with it is not on. And we, you know, many of us want to see the jurisdiction of the OMB limited to less than what it is now. We're the only province that has a tribunal that has that kind of a scope of a jurisdiction of things that can be appealed to it.
It's weird because you typically think of oversight as a good thing, but when we're talking about the OMB, and if you go to the OMB website and you look at Guelph, you can search the various appeals. There's a laundry list of appeals. Mm-hmm. It seems like
committee every, adjustment is like
every square inch of Guelph is under appeal. It seems
I mean, even I was on the committee of adjustment, so if we said no, like it's so easy for them just to go there, like anybody to go there,
mm-hmm.
and it whittles away at your zoning bylaw. So that, you know, that was why should those small minor variance decisions be taken out of a local hands? I mean, really, planning decisions are the only decisions that a council makes that are appealable to a tribunal like the OMB, other than things like the ward boundaries, as I mentioned before.
I mean, I've always got the impression of the OMB, from what I've seen, is that the developers generally get what they want. Is that a bit of a false impression? Or I've never heard otherwise in that it goes to the OMB because they don't get what they want, and then they wait for however long it is, and it's a huge waiting game, and then it's just like, okay, just do what you wanted.
I think
there's a trade-off. There's a trade-off somewhere.
Yeah.
We'll give you this for this. But other than that, it's like they just always seem to get what they want, and that's totally wrong in my view anyway.
I think there was a fellow at University of Toronto researcher who did work on this, and he wrote a book called A Law Unto Itself. His name was John Chipman, and he was part of our panel. And his studies found that, you know, that back then, I think this was 10 years ago when further back, that they didn't always, you know, it was pretty equal. But I think what happens maybe in the decisions that are equal, but what you said, you get into negotiations and settlement discussions with them, and yes, they get part of what they want, right? So rather than, for me, it doesn't always seem like win-win. Sometimes it seems like lose-lose. Like, so it you know, it's so we don't
so
really
set the bar high, and it's like, okay, well, we'll take this, and that's what we really wanted anyway.
Yeah, and so it's
18 stories instead of 14.
Yeah, so it's pretty, I think it's pretty frustrating for municipalities. I mean, for our planning staff, because, you know, they have to adhere, when they get zoning applications, they have to adhere to the existing, the old official plan that's really outdated and only have regard for the new one, which doesn't really carry any weight. So it's frustrating for our staff, too, like having to deal with the two documents.
And it adds an entirely new party to an equation and already has so much energy and passion to it. Because just like at the regular city council meetings, when it's a planning meeting and people getting up talking about developments in their neighborhood, even if it's just something small, like somebody wants to turn a house into a house on the doctor's office combo, there's just I mean, I understand the need for impartiality, but it brings another entity into this, into a situation where perhaps limiting the number of parties to making it more of a one-to-one process would make things easier.
Perhaps. It's hard. You know, the OMB is not really accountable to anybody. They're not really accountable even to the province. So they don't. Mm. They're not there to defend provincial policy. Even.
Right.
I mean, they're not accountable to them. I mean, that's what happened in Waterloo, too. I mean, they tried to put in more, to follow the provincial policy statement on growth, and they got taken to the OMB, and the province wasn't even there to defend them, and they lost and had to take them to court in the end. They did get some concessions, but it was a really bad situation. But
mm-hmm. At least lawyers are getting paid.
Yes, they're the ones getting rich.
We do have a couple of listener questions, and the first one, and I realize you're not on the committee, but perhaps you have some sort of insight, because this report did come to committee, hasn't come to the full council yet, but overtime is back in the news, and the city's spending too much on overtime. Is it a matter of planning, do you think? We don't plan enough for the number of hours staff are going to put in, or are we kind of lowballing it to make the budget look better at the beginning of the year?
I think it's hard to say. I know in water and wastewater and operations, I mean, probably their variance had a lot to do with the frozen pipes in 2015.
Very true.
You can't predict that type of what, like the weather and what's going to be happening.
Although I have seen city council try.
Yes, we have tried. And, you know, and some municipalities I know have reserves for those for snow plowing and things like that. But I think the frozen pipe added a lot of work, and so I'm sure that's quite justifiable in theirs. As far as transit, it is less than what it was previously in the audit. And as I said, I wasn't at the meeting, and I've only just skimmed the report. It'll be coming to council. You know, they're trying to take steps to deal with the overtime there, and whether it's, I'm not quite sure what it is. I mean, you know, the sick days, there's, I'm just not quite sure what the issue is. But I was glad to see that it was down in transit.
Mm-hmm.
And they did look at whether, because a number of people wonder whether it was, you know, the gapping. Do we have, are they holding, you know, they hold off to hire new people, so
right.
To fix to help their budgets, and apparently that wasn't the case, so it's not through gapping and that, but then you wonder, do we really, you know, are we so far stretched that we're not hiring the people that we need to be hiring?
Right.
You know what it is, such a battle at budget time getting those positions, and every one of those new positions that is asked for said this is what we need them for, and if we don't give them those positions, then they are stretched, and then you have to, you know, look at overtime often.
Another question somebody offered me, and it has a bit of buckshot in it, but I'll ask it anyway because somebody scroll.
Does it have taxpayer in it? No, I'm just.
It was somebody using the username Scroll Not Codex, so they're clearly a programmer of some kind. This is from Reddit. But they ask, why can't council get along? And I think, you know, when you hear this stuff happening in the news, you do ask that question.
Yeah.
But I think. On a day-to-day level, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, council for the most part does get along.
I think outside the council, like we're very pleasant to each other, you know, in the hallway and when we see each other and that. So it's not. I think it has gotten better recently. I think people like to. I'm a mediator, so it's an interesting. You know, because sometimes I find myself even, like, you know, participating in some of it.
It's
not really my, what
it's
I
like
value.
WrestleMania.
It's like, not really my value.
Carl Wettstein just is asking for it tonight.
Van Helden? Yeah.
But it's really important to keep the personal out of it.
Right.
And it's hard, I think, for many to do that. And so it's a very diverse council. But, I mean, the last time I was on was with Mayor Corey's term. And I found actually that was more unfriendly than
remember
this one.
Remember those days. Ooh.
That was my last term. So that was, so this one seems.
Not come back to make it good again. It's like,
this
whoa.
One seems like, right. And we're not having love-ins like London right now.
Oh! Where's that?
didn't need to tear up on that one.
Oh, excellent. Well done. that you know about.
That's right, that I know about. There.
We're going to spread some salacious details.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know where to go after that.
I agree. We have a responsibility. But, you know, just to say, we do have a responsibility to get along. It's always been my position that it doesn't matter whether I dislike or like other people around the horseshoe, whether I disagree with them. It's people elected them, and you have to respect who people put in there. So if you were put there, it's like an arranged marriage for 4 years, right? That's right. Your parents have given you these partners, the parents being the people who vote, and you know, you better get along. Like, it's important to respect each other and to try to find a way to work things
knowing through. That it'll be redrawn in a few years. Yeah, it's like,
another arrangement.
Exactly.
A lot of emphasis is put on the 7-6 votes.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, when as someone who is one of the votes, whether you're in the 7 or the 6, does that ever nag at you in the back of your head? Like, are we so divided? Is it just like everybody's voting their conscience and voting what they think their constituents want?
I actually think people are just voting the way that they... I vote the way I want to vote. I mean, I don't really tally up in before my head like whether it's going to be 7-6 or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that gets overplayed. You know, during the budget, last year I counted, like, there was 120 votes, and 22 of them were 7-6. And all the 7-6s were the same 7-6.
Right.
So I think it gets overplayed as a political strategy. I was on that before. I mean, Joe Young was, when I was on with him, I mean, he ran to get, you know, to stop the river run. But, you know, that was when he lost that vote, 7-6, and it was a 7-6 type council. You know, he just moved on and actually went on the river run board and things like that. So,
wow.
So I mean, it's just the way it plays out sometimes, right? And in some terms. But that's, again, you have to respect the people who elected us. And if that's the kind of balance they wanted, that's what we got.
And the River Run Center's still there.
And the River Run Center's still there.
Well, Kathy, unfortunately, our time together is up. But if you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you, and I mean, we are in the heart of Ward 5, as you say, so...
So, yeah, so you can email me at kathy.downer@guelph.ca.
And you're on the Twitter. We like to promote the Twitter.
I'm on Twitter at Kathy Downer, yeah. And I have a Facebook page, you know, and I friend usually people that are in Guelph. So, yeah, so you can get a hold of me any one of those ways. Like I said, Twitter and Kathy.Downer. Kathy with a C, by the way.
Okay, with a C.
C-A-T-H-Y, downer@guelph.ca.
Spelling counts.
Yeah.
Well, we want to thank you for coming in, and we know that you, like every member of council, is a very busy person, so we appreciate you taking the time to engage with us here on Open Sources.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And because we are engaging, we have Police Chief Jeff DeReuter coming up on the 30th. And we'll keep you updated with future guests, of course. You can go to our website, opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, and at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. We have our weekly podcast on Podbean. Just go to the Guelph Politicast channel and download away, and you can listen to Open Sources Guelph wherever and whenever you are. On whatever you listen to find podcasts on. You can connect with me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter. I write at a place called The Spanner Book. And I know what I'm going to say at the start of the show from now on. From the heart of Ward 5. I never had a thing. Now I have
great,
a thing. So
good.
Deep in the heart of Ward 5 at the University of Guelph, it is Open Sources. Da 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 da. There.
Yeah, and now, I like that. But now we're going to have everybody saying we should do remotes from their ward.
So. See, you're biased. It's all about Ward 5. Yeah.
Anyway, we are biased for DJ Sounds Good to Me. She is at the top of the hour here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back with you next week for another brand new edition of Open Sources, and we will see you then. We'll be right back.
home.